I'm here as counsel for Sunday Lucas, who I will continue to refer to as Lucas throughout this proceeding. I'll continue to refer to the appellees cumulatively as the defendants. I thought it was easy to separate out the parties, Daryl Hacken, Robert Ford as Hacken Ford, Stanley Furman as Dr. Furman, and the balance of the defendants is Sheriff Woody or Sheriff Woody et al. This suit was filed because as an inmate at the Richmond City Jail, Lucas was denied medical treatment for some 2 weeks, and as a result of that, she suffered a stroke and permanent neurological injuries. I'd like to bring to the court's attention, reading the brief this weekend, there's a correction to my opening brief, top of page 25. This paragraph should be spaced and indented to indicate that it's a quote, and the next sentence down, from that, what should be an indented paragraph, the word we should be deleted. A primary issue in this case is, does Virginia Code Section 801.243.2, that I call the Virginia's Prisoner Statute, apply to former prisoners? Lucas takes the straightforward approach, and that is that that statute means what it says. The defendants disagree with that approach. Although I think some of the defendants claim that the plain language of the statute supports their position, which kind of begs the question, then why didn't any other of the parties or any judges who have ever reviewed this, including the trial court, not come to that conclusion? Ms. Lucas completed her jail time 2 months after the incidents giving rise to this litigation. Her release from jail prevented her from pursuing administrative remedies, and her condition prior to release prevented her from pursuing administrative remedies. She was not physically or mentally competent to have done that. However, what I call desperation to prevail on a technicality, the defendants claim that to follow the plain language of the statute would lead to absurd results. Actually, Lucas agrees that the statute does lead to absurd results, but for a different reason. Certainly, the legislative intent of the statute, which is to provide prison officials to responsibly address an inmate's concern, is laudable. However, in practice, it is the proverbial fox who guards the chicken coop. They're asked to assess themselves. We need look no further than this case here. Ms. Lucas begged for treatment. Her fellow inmate said, take her to the hospital, and they punished her by putting her in isolation. When I read the defendant's brief this weekend, I realized that I've struggled with what it is they don't understand. They all keep referring to the phrase, quote, when the cause of action accrues, end quote, as if that phrase will magically save them from the plain language of the statute. However, they don't then connect the dots or create a syllogism as to what they mean by when the cause of action accrues. Perhaps they want us to believe that the statute of limitations is determined when the cause of action accrues and cannot be changed by intervening events. However, that's not true. Let's assume a 25-year-old person without any mental or physical disabilities is rear-ended in a car accident. They have sprains and strains. They're not unconscious. They're not medically or physically disabled, but they have some sprains and strains. 6 months later, this healthy 25-year-old adult gets an infection, totally unrelated to the car accident, and goes into a coma for a month. Well, then the statute of limitations is told for at least a month, and the period is extended. In fact, if we look at Virginia's prisoner statute, the statute of limitations is not determined when the cause of action accrues by its very language. There's language in there to the effect of 6 months after the administrative remedies are concluded and a year after the incident, whichever period is longer. Another significant issue in this case...
But, counsel, am I wrong about this? Your reading of the statute seems to be that once a prisoner is injured, we don't know what the statute of limitations is until we figure out where she is 1 year from now. I mean, that's very different than the tolling provision that you just explained. I mean, at the time of the injury, we know what the statute of limitations is, but there might be a tolling provision. And it seems to me your read of the statute is she gets injured, but we don't know what the statute of limitations is until we figure out where she is 1 year from now.
Oh.
Because then it might be 2 years. For example, let's say she gets injured in jail, she gets out, but then she gets picked up for DUI, and the 1 year is about to end. Or, I mean, she would have a 2 year statute of limitations under your theory because she's out of jail.
Correct.
She gets picked up for DUI and she's in jail right before the 1 year ends. Suddenly, she's got a 1 year statute of limitations because she's confined again.
I don't know the answer to that question, but we're stuck with the way the statute is worded. And as I see it, but I disagree that the first initial premise that she's in jail, we know what the statute of limitations is. We don't know. In part because she has to be given an opportunity to pursue administrative remedies. When will those remedies end? Things like that. So we don't know even as the statute is written.
Well, we do know because we know it's, at latest it's going to be 6 months after those administrative remedies have been concluded.
But when will that be? I know I'm not supposed to ask you a question, but we don't know when they...
We don't know when it is, but we know what it is.
Yeah, if she...
It's not like ephemeral. It's not like, oh, it could be 15, it could be 20. No, I mean, we've got a rule that tells us exactly how it's going to work. We just follow the rule 6 months after the administrative remedy is over.
Okay, if she remains incarcerated. That's what the statute says.
And if she doesn't, what happens?
It's 2 year statute of limitations from the type date of the incident.
Well, under your scenario, under your reading, what's your answer to Justice McClanahan's question? You've got an ever-changing statute of limitations.
That's correct. That's correct. As when a person gets into a coma or anything like that.
Well, that's a tolling. That's not that tolls, but you know that the statute of limitations is 2 years. But whether it's tolls is a different question. You're not arguing tolling here.
No, I'm not arguing.
And in fact, it's almost just opposite. You're saying if you're still under disability by being incarcerated, you got a shorter period of time than if you're free and you got plenty of time to work on anything.
It's an absurd statute. that's correct.
According to your interpretation, it would be.
Yes, yes. Yes, it is.
Well, counsel, I know very, very, very well the person who introduced this statute.
Okay. Very good.
Very well.
Okay. I hope that helps me.
I don't know that saying that it's an absurd statute helps. But there is an anomaly within the statute, which is why the seven of us have to make a decision.
Yes, that's correct.
Go ahead.
And of course, under the federal statute, which basically parallels the Virginia prisoner statute, the same result has been reached there for many, many years, that it does not apply to a former prisoner. The clear intent.
Let me ask you a different question, counsel. What do we do with Bing, if we agree with you? What do we do with that case?
It doesn't affect Bing at all. The two issues in Bing, as I see it, does it, as a person who's a pretrial detainee, is that person considered to be confined? And that was reached.
Right.
And does a body cavity search, is that referred to the conditions of her confinement? And in fact, the denial of medical treatment in this case, we agree, is part of Lucas's confinement. We agree with that. So Bing does not address our issues here at all. Bing can remain in full force and effect.
So the language that says for the 1 year provision to apply, the plaintiff must have been confined at the time of the cause of action accrued, and the cause of action must relate to the conditions of confinement.
That's correct.
Okay.
And it was relevant to the issues that were in that case.
I agree with that. But did we say something a little too far if we want to agree with you?
No, I disagree. I think you could just simply say it's distinguished because in our case, Lucas was not incarcerated when she filed suit. So, I mean, that's...
But Bing doesn't say anything about when you file suit. It says when the cause of action accrued.
That was... I don't recall. I'm not sure what the court's question is.
You're talking about something completely different from what Justice Millett just quoted to you from Bing. Would you repeat again, Justice Millett?
It says, for the one-year provision in 801-243-2 to apply, in other words, this is the only time it applies, the plaintiff must have been confined at the time the cause of action accrued.
And so at the time of the cause of action accrued is when they had to be incarcerated, is what we said in Bing. It doesn't say anything about when you filed it. You're saying that you have to be incarcerated when you file it for the one-year statute of limitations.
The issue that I'm bringing was not addressed in Bing, which is, does it apply to a former prisoner? It was not addressed because Bing was incarcerated when she filed suit. That's the difference.
Yeah, I guess the only problem that I see with that is we didn't say anything about her being incarcerated as being relevant in Bing.
It wasn't relevant to the issue in Bing because she was incarcerated. The issue did.
I don't think you can tell from Bing whether she was incarcerated when she filed suit or not.
You can't tell from the language in Bing. However, counsel for the defendants insisted on filing a stipulation that was filed with the court that she was incarcerated. Issues moot on the point. Not only can you not tell from the language of the case law, but certainly the issue was not raised that I'm bringing to the court.
Let me ask you an additional question. You said a minute ago that the statute was absurd, and you retracted that, I think. Does it lead to absurd results to apply the plain language of it?
Well, for the reasons I gave you, yes, because of the fox guard and the chicken cooping. Well, what's in one of the cases, I'm trying to think, it was in the Jackson.
Well, what does our statutory construction say about when is it an absurd result? When does it occur? Isn't it either when it's internally inconsistent or at least it's impractical to operate otherwise? Which one of those applies?
I'm not sure about that, but I do know that this court has ruled many times.
Counsel, let me help you with that.
Yes.
In 2004 and 2010, we said that an absurd result describes situations in which the law would be internally inconsistent or otherwise incapable of operation. In 2006, we said an absurd result is a conflict between statutory provisions. Gillette's question, but my question for both sides is going to be, does the absurd result analysis apply to this case and why?
It does not apply in the case at bar because it's very clear that the intent was that it only applied to someone who's incarcerated. And we know that because the language says that, and plus the person who is supposed to be filing suit has to pursue administrative remedies.
But counsel, your argument would never get to intent because you believe that the plain language of the statute is not ambiguous.
No, it's not. It's unambiguous. That is correct. Mm-hmm. I have limited time. Very briefly, another issue would be whether or not at the September hearing in the matter, the trial court resolved the issue whether or not Lucas had been reasonably diligent and there would be no prejudice to the defendants in pursuing in granting an amendment to allow Section 93 cause of action. I'll briefly refer to the transcript from that hearing. The appendix, page 120, top of the page, I say, this is at the September hearing, I request leave of court to file an amended complaint. Continuing over to page 122 of the joint appendix, Mr. Collinbell speaking on behalf of Sheriff Woody, he mentions, this is at the September hearing, the first time we were in this case, Judge Spencer had the case and the issue of Section 1983 action came up, but Judge Spencer even addressed the issue to Mr. Hirschner. Mr. Hirschner did everything in his power to avoid removal of the case, to avoid a Section 1983 action. That's what was stated at the September hearing. The judge had initially, when I first mentioned about amending, kind of said no, he wouldn't allow it, and with further argument. Now, Mr. Collinbell, at the top of page 23 of the appendix, he was aware of his ability to bring a Section 1983 action. This is not a theory he just thought of. This was brought to him. And then Judge, the trial court, bottom of page 29, Mr. Hirschner, my reaction was, in part, based on what Mr. Collinbell has now referred to, and that is, I did read the pleas, of course, that this case had been previously filed and non-suited, given that history. Shouldn't the court hold the plaintiff to standard that requires that those claims that are known that could be plausibly brought be made timely? And he goes on to grant the amendment. So when defendants claim that issue was not resolved in Lucas's favor at the September hearing, that conflicts with the record. If I could save my last 25 seconds for rebuttal, I'd appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Mark Columbell on behalf of Appalese Sheriff Woody, Minion Graham, Laura Terry, Anika Brown, Carolyn Quigley, Robert Cushenberry, and Ivanka Lewis. At council table are Ms. Liner on behalf of Appalese Daryl Hack and Robert Ford, and Ms. Essig on behalf of Appalese Stanley Furman. Ms. Liner and Ms. Essig join in oral argument. The first assignment of error asks this court to examine 801.243.2, and in order to do that, we have to delve into the well-settled tenets of statutory construction.
Let me ask you first, counsel. Do you disagree that the plain language of that statute seems to say that the person has to be confined at the time the cause of action is brought and has to be brought within 1 year?
The plain language of that statute, and I think the key words are no person confined, and our interpretation of that statute is no person confined refers to the time at the cause of action accrued.
Where do you get that without adding language in there?
The
cause of action accrued.
What ambiguity do you find in order to even reach that issue?
Well, what I have in my back pocket is Bing v. Haywood.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute, but I'm talking to you about the plain language. Tell me what in the plain language helps you reach the conclusion you reach.
Well, the plain language talks about exhaustion of available administrative remedies. And when it talks about exhaustion of available administrative remedies, it's clear the General Assembly took into account there would be situations in which people would not be able to exhaust their administrative remedies. Case in point is this case where Ms. Lucas was released from jail 2 months after this incident happened. On page 8 of the opening brief, Ms. Lucas concedes she was unable to exhaust her available administrative remedies. Therefore, the one-year provision would take into effect. Clearly, the General Assembly realized that not at all times people would be able to exhaust those. So by providing the two alternate limitation periods, the plain language clearly demonstrates that the General Assembly thought that there would be situations in which people who were released from jail would still be subject to this statute of limitations. Then, second, Bing v. Haywood. Bing v. Haywood talks about the accrual of the cause of action. And I agree with this court absolutely about their summary of Bing v. Haywood. Bing v. Haywood painted with a much broader brush than is conceded by Ms. Lucas. Bing v. Haywood, on page 385 of the opinion, a plaintiff
must... I hate to interrupt you, counsel, but I think you've gotten away from the plain language question I was asking and even Justice Mims' question about where the ambiguity is in the statute. Have you gotten to that yet? I maybe missed it.
No, sir. Well, I think, and maybe I could address it another way, would absurd results... if we were to follow Ms. Lucas's interpretation of the statute, would absurd results manifest themselves?
Because that's the only way you're going to get beyond the plain language is an absurd result analysis. You can't look at intent.
Well, then, absolutely. If we look at...
Well, let's go back to your ambiguity question. Because isn't the ambiguity what the definition of such a person is in the second sentence of the statute? Because it says, such action shall be brought by on behalf of such person within 1 year. Well, what is such person? Is such person a person confined at the time they were injured?
Yes, sir.
I mean, and so that's the ambiguity, isn't it?
I don't believe it's an ambiguity, though, because I think if you take any of the examples that have been raised by this court about the manifest absurdities that result if you adopted Ms. Lucas's interpretation, and there's an additional manifest absurdity. Let's take the example of...
Well, let's talk about that. What's your definition of absurdity? You heard Justice Mims ask counsel what... told him what the definition was. What do you think is absurd about that?
That's why I'll repeat. There's three problems. You've got to fit into one of the three. It's either got to be inconsistent, it's got to be incapable of operation, or it's got to conflict with another statutory provision.
Then there are two, at least two manifest absurdities that could result. One, internal inconsistency, and two, conflict between statutory provisions. The first, inconsistencies. We could have a situation in which inmate X is incarcerated.
The language has got to be internally inconsistent. What is internally inconsistent about the statute so that it can't work? Now, you're going to talk about situations that seem to be not fair or reach anomalous results in different circumstances. Is that internally inconsistent?
I believe it is. If it's being inconsistently applied to similarly situated individuals. So, for example...
Do we have any case law that says that?
that uses our statutory construction rules to say it's applied differently to different individuals, it's internally inconsistent?
Well, not before this court, not today. But the absurd results we do have is inmate X is incarcerated on day one and exhausts their administrative and is injured. They exhaust their administrative remedies within 30 days. And they're incarcerated for 18 months and then subsequently released.
I can see the anomalous, the examples you've given us would give us anomalous results, but you're not really convinced me that it's internally inconsistent, so go on to your next one. What
well, conflict? Then a conflict between statutory provisions.
Okay, tell me that one.
801.230 states that a cause of action, and this court has, in citing to the Harris opinion, discusses the interplay between 801.230 and 801.243.2. 801.230 is a cause of action accrues and the statute of limitations begins running from the date the injury is sustained. Ms. Lucas's interpretation of the statute is inconsistent with 801.230.
How is that? She agrees it begins running when the cause of action accrues. It's just the period that it ends that she takes issue with.
I respectfully disagree. I think she says that we're looking to the day she files suit to determine when the statute, what statute of limitation applies.
Sure, that's when the statute runs, not when it begins. She says it begins, certainly, when the cause of action accrues. It's either 1 year if she's still incarcerated or 2 years if she's not.
But what 801.230 says is the prescribed limitation period begins to run. So what I take that to mean is 801.243.2. I don't think there's any arguing that at the time someone sustains an injury in jail and they begin exhausting their administrative remedies, that 243.2 applies to that person. What he's saying is as soon as they are released from jail, it no longer applies to that person. But what 230 says is that we look at the time the cause of action accrues to not only start the running.
I think what he's saying, not to interrupt you again, but I think what he's saying is you look at the time when the person files a suit to see whether the statute of limitations is run or not. I think that's what he's saying. And what's wrong with that?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
At the time the person files a suit, then you look to see whether the statute of limitations is run or not. What's wrong with that analysis?
That analysis would result in, as this court pointed out, you'd have a situation where you could have a complete fluctuating statute of limitations. You could have someone who goes to jail, is released from jail, goes back to jail for 30 days, is released from jail, and all this time the statute of limitations is going like this.
Maybe the General Assembly thought that was okay.
I'm sorry?
Maybe the General Assembly thought that was okay under these circumstances.
I think we go back to then the well-settled principles of statutory construction, which is that we try and give effect to the legislative intent. The legislative intent of this statute is to address the quantity and quality of lawsuits brought by individuals who are injured while confined. And
Justice Mims, what do you think about that?
It's to address it. It's not an answer to it. It's to address it.
Or unless the purpose is to discriminate against people who are incarcerated.
I don't believe that's the case. I think when I say...
I don't know.
I think the purpose is to address the quantity and quality of suits. That's why they have an administrative process. Harkening back to my days as a law clerk, a lot of my time was responding to letters from inmates complaining about conditions of the jail. Of course, that's going to happen. There are situations which there is merit to claims brought in the jail. There are situations where there are frivolous claims brought by inmates in jail. So the purpose of this statute is to address the quantity and quality. But going back to statutory construction,
if indeed one is presuming that the underlying intent is to weed out the frivolous cases, is this case frivolous?
Is this case frivolous, Your Honor? We never got to the merits of the case.
Are you making any argument that this case is frivolous,
Judge? Your Honor, I think it's premature for me to stand at this podium and say that this case is frivolous.
Presuming that this case is not frivolous, would the General Assembly be intending to weed out a case of this nature?
If she failed to file beyond the prescribed statute of limitation period, yes. She filed 18 months after her cause of action accrued. She brought a 1983 action almost 4.5 years after her cause of action accrued. Statute of limitations, and we'll get into this argument, they're more rigid, a more rigid application of the law than leave to amend. And we have kind of confused these principles in this case. Just because the trial court thought it was appropriate to provide Mr. Hirshner leave to assert a claim doesn't mean the court was ruling on statute of limitations or any other affirmative defense. I think the General Assembly says if you filed outside this period, then certainly they were saying that you're out of luck. But again, I think the most important, the court in Commonwealth v. Zamani, 256 Virginia 391, and this is quoting, the plain, obvious, and rational meaning. And I would really urge this court to look at the rational meaning of this statute is to be preferred over any curious, narrow, or strained construction. A statute is not to be construed by singling out a particular phrase. Every part is presumed to have some effect, is not to be disregarded unless absolutely necessary. And when two statutes seemingly conflict, they should both be harmonized, if at all possible, to give effect to both. Our interpretation of the statute is consistent with that rule of statutory construction. Our interpretation of the statute is consistent with Bing v. Haywood. Our interpretation of the statute is consistent with 801.230. And I believe Ms. Lucas's interpretation of the statute is not. Moving on to the claim, and prior to moving on to the 1983 action, an absurdity exists in this case right here. Ms. Lucas was incarcerated. She took a non-suit of her case, and she was reincarcerated. Ms. Lucas was incarcerated on January 31st of 2012. Upon her release the next day, she filed suit on February 1st of 2012. If we were to accept Ms. Lucas's interpretation of this statute, then this court would be saying a claim that was time-barred on January 31st is all of a sudden revived on February 1st. That's an absurd result that this court should not allow. That is the first absurd result that I highlighted in our brief, where it talks about a person who's incarcerated for 18 months.
Well, it's not necessarily absurd. It's just bad policy.
Well, I just can't think of another situation, Justice Lemons, where you can revive a cause of action. Now,
when the legislature gets to decide those questions, and it might not be the policy that I would pursue if I was in the legislature, but in order for it to be absurd, it can't work. Here, it can work. It's just probably bad policy.
Well, I think for it to be absurd, it can't work, or it has to be inconsistent, or it has to conflict with the statutory provision.
Mr. Collenbell,
yes,
doesn't the statute intend that the condition of her confinement that gave rise to the cause of action be the one on which she is confined? And so the description that you just gave of being reconfined on a different claim, if you will, does not apply to this code section. So if you're confined on the cause of action that gave rise to the cause of action, on the confined condition of confinement.
That is not my understanding of Ms. Lucas's position. My understanding of Ms. Lucas's position was if you're confined at the time of filing suit, then this statute applies.
But the statute itself says relating to the condition of the confinement.
Well, Justice Powell, I think that when it says that, I think that's even more reason that this court must adopt that we're talking about at the time the cause of action accrues. Therefore, consistent with the holding in Bing. If you look at the statute, and I'm not asking the court to substitute words, and I'm not asking to redraft the statute, but if we took the first sentence and put, no person denied medical treatment in a state or local correctional facility shall bring or have brought, that makes the statute crystal clear. No person beaten in a state or local correctional facility shall bring or have brought. That makes the statute crystal clear. When you read it that way, you read it that no person confined must mean at the time the cause of action accrues. Talking about the 1980...
You're saying confined means beaten or not given treatment? That's a stretch, isn't it?
No, I'm saying...
That's how you did it. That's the word you substituted for.
No, you're talking about what happened to them while they...
Well, I know. That's the word you substituted for.
Well, whatever injury they incurred. I'm just... Hypotheticals.
Okay.
But quickly moving on, I have a minute left to talk about the 1983 claim. Ms. Lucas was provided leave to amend to assert a 1983 claim. Immediately following the 1983 claim, she filed a second amended motion to file an amended complaint to raise the claims that were just deemed time barred by the trial court, and a 1983 claim. The court denied that motion for leave to amend the second amended complaint because he already ruled on the state law claims. The court then took up the issue of timeliness of the 1983 claim. The only issue before this court is whether it was an abuse of discretion to deny that second amended complaint. The timeliness of the 1983 claim is not properly before this court. Even if it is, we look to 801.6.1 to talk about whether she was reasonably diligent in asserting the claim. 4.5 years elapsed since the accrual of a 1983 action, and in Ms. Lucas's brief, she states, the defendants have dispensed much ink to establish something that Lucas has readily admitted. She did not file a 1983 action, so their case would not be removed to federal court. That's not reasonable diligence to avoid removal to federal court. Thank you.
Thank you. You've got a few seconds for rebuttal.
There's time now, do I? Very briefly, what counsel left out about the motion to amend was that the issue was addressed, resolved in Lucas's favor at the September hearing. They try to say it's not because there's no specific mention of
8016.1. Well, they're saying it's not because the court said it wasn't. The court interpreted what he did on the earlier hearing and clearly said, I never reached that issue.
But the record conflicts with that, Judge. I guess my time, Justice, that, I guess my time is up.
Mr. Hirsch, before you sit down,
yes.
I'm very acquainted with the author of Ben. Justice Mims is acquainted with the author of the statute. I don't think Bing answers your question. I think it leaves it open.
I don't think Bing addresses the issue.
Yeah.
That's what I think. Bing does not address the issue.
There's two places. One, for the one-year provision to apply, the plaintiff must have been confined at the time of the cause of action accrued.
Correct.
Everybody agrees with that.
Yeah.
And the second place where it addresses it, the one-year statute of limitations to apply, Bing must have been a person confined in a state or local correctional facility. I don't think either one of those things says where the person has to be when they file it.
That's correct. It doesn't address the issue here.
All right.
Thank you.
Call the next case, please.